Hello.
Hi, hello.
Hello from wherever you are. Good afternoon, good evening, good night, good morning, wherever it is that you are. I'm so glad you're all here. Yes, please turn on your cameras. I want to see all your amazing faces. I'm so excited to see you. Let me adjust my camera so I'm not cutting the top of my head off. Everyone can hear me okay. Yes. Perfect. Whoops. Did not mean to turn my video off. All right. Hi, everyone. Let me just make sure that my podcast microphone is the one that is working. Great. All right. As usual, we will have a workshop about an hour long. Then we'll take a break. Then we'll do the other half of the workshop. Then we'll take another break. And then we'll do Q&A. So same as all of our other workshops. And I'll stay on for as long as you guys need for getting your questions answered. Any questions before we begin, though? Does anyone need to ask anything or share anything or no? Okay. I have to say, I've never taught a workshop in the afternoon. It's like 2 p.m. here. I've never taught a workshop in the afternoon and it feels so weird. Like, it's like I usually do this in the evening. This is so weird. It's interesting, but whatever. It's fine. Okay. So if you can turn your camera on, I would love to see your face. If you can't turn your camera on, that's totally fine. Yeah, you'll get the replay. Sorry about the replay from last time being delayed so much. If you guys are following me on Instagram, you know that David and I, or really David, let's be honest, it hasn't been me, has been remodeling a bathroom, and a project that he thought would take a couple of weeks ended up taking 6 weeks and required way more trips to the hardware store, which is 70 miles away, than we were anticipating. So it was a very long, drawn out process. And unfortunately for y'all, a lot of emails and replays and stuff got delayed as he was like pushing to finish that project because he just finished it last week. And last week I was like, I can't do it anymore. Like, I can't do this like mess and like, I can't anymore. And so he like pushed really hard to fix it, which meant he wasn't getting replays out. So I'm sorry. but we do have a fully now remodeled bathroom that he did all by himself, and it's beautiful and we love it and we're using it. So yeah, anyway, I apologize that the replay went out a lot later than what we normally do. We normally do within 48 hours, but that was within like 5 days. So I don't think that that will happen again. So yeah, if there are no other questions, then I'm going to share my screen and we will get started. As always, please save any questions for me until the end. But of course, if you have a question about a resource or you need a link or you're having an issue with your account or payment or something like that, David is in the chat and can answer those questions for you there. But I am not watching the chat right now. So today's workshop is called Untriggered. Welcome so much. We are going to talk about welcome so much. Welcome so much. Welcome, everyone. I'll tell you more about myself in every workshop. So I'll tell you a little bit more about kind of the home study part of me today. I was raised on a quarter horse and paint horse ranch in the Texas Panhandle. So for my entire childhood, we had a herd of horses. We had barns, pens, round pens, stables, foaling stalls, all of it. I have delivered horses. I have artificially inseminated horses. I have been with horses when they've died. I am so grateful for this part of my childhood. I mean, I'm grateful for all of my childhood now, but I would say the horse part of my childhood was really like a highlight for me. And I really enjoyed spending time with the horses. Being in the barn felt like a really safe place for me because nobody was there judging me or demanding perfectionism or yelling at me or swinging a belt at me. So I love, love, love horses. And my parents bred and sold paint and quarter horses. So today I live in the woods of northeastern Minnesota. So 1,200 miles north of where I grew up is where I live today. Never ever thought that I would find myself living anywhere but Texas. I was one of those like Texas forever kind of people. And leaving Texas was such a good decision that we made for our family. So we have a little homestead. I need to update this slide. We actually have 24 chickens right now. Five of them are going to be butchered in like 2 weeks. So then we will have 19 chickens. The 19 chickens that we have left over, though, are the layer birds, so they're not going to get butchered because they lay eggs. Right now, I think I have like 6 dozen eggs sitting on my counter. So it's unfortunate that none of you live close enough to me that I can share some eggs with you because we have a lot of eggs right now. I love foraging for food and plant medicine. I love making plant medicine and I love growing food. We have a garden and I make many of my own tinctures using wild foraged plants from where I live. I didn't know anything about medicinal plants in Texas because it's so hot, dry, and windy that I never wanted to be outside in the summertime. So now that I live in a place that's like much easier to be outside, I'm like always in the woods finding things that I love to make plant medicine with. And before I was a trauma and nervous system coach, I was a food blogger. I started my food blog in 2012, I think. And it was just like a blogspot.com little blog. And then over the years, it grew. And I ended up having all of this like organic traffic and people finding me. And then I changed the name of my blog in 2018. And that's when I really decided to like try to make a go of like, let's see if I can actually make a really good income off of this. And I did end up making a good income off of it. And then I sold it in June of 2021. So I no longer have the food blog, but in case you're interested, they're an organic food company bought it and now they use it to put blogs up about their products. But if you want to stalk it and like go back into the archives, like you're going to have to go 3 years back to find the stuff that's actually mine. But my website was called All the Nourishing Things. So I've had people in workshops who are like, oh my God, I used to follow you. And that's really weird too. That's like a very like, wow, you've seen me come full circle in this journey of mine. I don't do that anymore. But anyway, if you want to check it out, it was a paleo, keto, Whole30 vegan food blog called All the Nourishing Things. So yeah, that's a little bit more about me. As y'all know, I'm not a licensed mental health provider. So whatever you learn in this workshop is for educational purposes only. Please do not use this as a substitute for healthcare. And please be responsible with your healthcare choices. Also, everything in this presentation is my original stuff. If I am using or quoting someone else's work, I will cite them. And if they have a book or something like that, David will put the resource link in the chat for you. I do not care if you take screenshots or whatever else and share them on social media as long as you tag me. The next workshop, workshop number three, is called Overcoming Health Anxiety. Even if you don't have health anxiety specifically, I still really encourage you to come because, as you'll learn in the workshop, anxiety is anxiety is anxiety. It just finds different things to focus on. So, but health anxiety is kind of a big part of why Feel Without Fear even exists to begin with, because I was going through another round of health anxiety whenever the phrase Feel Without Fear dropped into my awareness. So it is specifically about that, but even if you don't have health anxiety, you'll still benefit from it and you can apply it to whatever your anxiety likes to land on. So that's going to be on September 25th at 10 a.m. Central. And then the following Tuesday on October 1st at 2 p.m. Central will be our group coaching call. So hopefully your calendars have that date marked or both of those. And today we are going to talk about triggers, and we will start with triggers and your brain and your nervous system. So the first part of this is kind of science heavy, which hopefully all of you guys are nerds the way that I'm nerds and a nerd, and you want to know the science behind a lot of this. So it is science heavy, but then it's also not science heavy. The whole thing is not science. So let's get started. What is a trigger? My definition of a trigger is it's a present moment resurrection of past trauma or emotional experiences. So you are triggered because some part of you is having a similar emotional experience to an emotional experience or trauma that you had at some point in your life. And your body is so smart that it wants to do everything possible to avoid those scary things from ever happening again. And so we have these big reactions in our bodies because our body is like, no, stay away. Don't go there. That's scary. But as we know, oftentimes our triggers are not reflective of a threat that's actually present. It's often a perceived threat. So when we are faced with a present moment, now situation, or a person that elicits an uncomfortable emotional response similar to a past trauma or emotional experience, we say we are triggered. So even though the actual trauma isn't happening in the present moment, the body and the ego, one of your kids on the bus, are reacting as if it is happening in the moment. So in complex PTSD, triggers are called emotional flashbacks. So I'll use those terms interchangeably, flashback trigger. In The Body Keeps the Score, Bessel van der Kolk says many people may not be aware of the connection between their crazy feelings and reactions and the traumatic events that are being replayed. They have no idea why they respond to some minor irritation as if they were about to be annihilated. So whether it's a present moment resurrection of a past trauma or a normal empathetic response to disturbing things, your nervous system is dysregulated. And so from that place of dysregulation, that's when we go into our coping mechanisms, or maybe avoidance is our coping mechanism, and we have these unconscious reactions that happen. So Pete Walker in Complex PTSD defines a trigger as an external or internal stimulus that activates us into an emotional flashback. And this often occurs outside the boundaries of normal consciousness. This is why I teach about awareness first, because we're taking what is unconscious and making it conscious when we are having awareness. The bottom line is that the threat perception system of the brain has changed, and people's physical reactions are dictated by the imprint of the past. So, does everyone like understand and can identify when your present moment feelings or reactions or whatever are being dictated by something that's not actually happening in the present moment? Okay, awesome. Okay, a trigger can also be, so here's where we're going to define like a little bit of a difference. A trigger can also be normal but intense feelings of disgust, disturbance, fear, and helplessness in response to disturbing things. So if you were to see images of graphic violence or animal cruelty or destruction of the planet or human trafficking or something like that, like it would be very normal to feel extremely uncomfortable or disgusted or hopeless or helpless about those things. But that is not the same thing as the complex PTSD triggers that we're talking about in today's workshop. So, CPTSD triggers are often much more subtle, much more nebulous. Sometimes you can have a hard time putting your finger on exactly what's wrong or exactly what's coming up. But you are a totally normal human if you are disturbed by disturbing things. Okay, that's not the kind of trigger I'm talking about. Also, from The Body Keeps the Score, people who are triggered or in a flashback often organize their lives around trying to protect against being triggered. So, if elements of the trauma are replayed again and again, the accompanying stress hormones engrave those memories ever more deeply in the mind. Not being able to deeply take in what is going on around them makes it impossible to feel fully alive. It becomes harder to feel the joys and aggravations of ordinary life, harder to concentrate on the tasks at hand, and not being fully alive in the present keeps them more firmly imprisoned in the past. Your brain and nervous system do not behave differently depending on whether the threat is real or perceived. So, a real threat is when there's actual danger present. This is when you're like walking through the woods and you hear a stick crack off in the distance and you stop in your tracks and you become very alert and aware and you're listening because it's very possible that that stick cracking is a bear walking through the woods who has caught your scent and like wants to come and hunt you, right? That's a real threat. But a trigger is often a perceived threat, meaning there's not actually a bear present, but the body and the mind are reacting as if there is. So when you are triggered, you are having a now nervous system moment response to a past event, situation, person, or feeling. And the now moment experience is simply reflective, like a mirror of the past experience that may still feel unresolved or still feels raw or something like that. And I believe that we need triggers, that they do serve a very helpful purpose, because our bodies are so smart that every time we get triggered, it's the body putting us in a situation to try to resolve it. So when we get triggered by the same thing over and over again, think of how many opportunities you have. If you can be present and in awareness when you're having that trigger, that is actually an opportunity to fully resolve that trigger, or to turn the intensity down or turn the volume down on that trigger. So this is why I don't feel like we need to avoid all of our triggers, but I also don't think we need to heal all of our triggers either. So until the trigger is faced, you will continue to live in fear of being triggered. And this most often looks like avoidance, avoiding people, places, situations, social media accounts, et cetera, because those things poke or trigger those overwhelming past emotions or sensations. But sometimes it's not avoidance of the trigger itself, it's avoidance of the responsibility that is required on your part to face the trigger. And some part of you doesn't feel ready or doesn't think you need to accept responsibility for how you feel in that moment. Sometimes a trigger is a misdirected fight response that looks like blaming, shaming, gaslighting, or manipulating other people so that you don't have to feel the discomfort of the trigger or take responsibility for yourself. So sometimes you're not avoiding it, but you're like, something gets poked in you and all of a sudden you're just like really angry and blaming and shaming the other person. And it's a way to avoid sitting with that trigger and being curious about it and kind of trying to get to the bottom of it and feel your way through it. If you can attack instead, then that's another way that your body and your ego can protect you from having to feel the trigger that you subconsciously believe you wouldn't be able to handle if you were to face it. But it's not failure or avoidance of triggers if you feel deeply disturbed by disturbing things like I talked about earlier. We humans are naturally empathetic. We are wired to feel other people's pain. Some of us feel other people's emotions and pain more deeply than others. But these are not the kinds of triggers that we want to get over, because if we want to try to get over having an empathetic response and feeling disturbed by deeply disturbing things, then that would actually be an attempt to like not be human anymore. And that's not possible really for any of us. And it's not what we want to do anyway. Like, we don't want to outheal our humanness, right? We still want to be empathetic. We still want to be disturbed by disturbing things. Even if we don't want to see those things all the time, it's still a natural response. And it's okay if you want to avoid those things. Like if I get like a abused, abandoned, neglected like dog video in my feed, like I swipe past it immediately. I do not want to sit there and watch it because it's so disturbing to me. And because I have dogs and my dogs are like my kids and like, they're so special that I cannot imagine the way people treat dogs sometimes. And so like, I don't feel that I need to consume that content and like face that over and over and over, when I know the best thing that I can do for that is just to scroll past it and go love on my own dogs. You know, like that's really the best thing I could do in that situation. So that's why I'm saying, I don't think we have to like face everything and be like, oh my God, I get so triggered by graphic animal violence. I need to heal this about myself. No, you don't. You should be triggered by graphic animal violence, right? Like, it's disturbing. So those again are not the kinds of triggers I'm talking about. You can absolutely work through facing triggers on your own or with a trusted other person, such as a friend or a partner. You may also need a therapist or a coach to help you work through some bigger triggers or some tricky triggers. And it is smart to proceed carefully because you are dealing with like a heavy or big emotional thing that you may not feel equipped to deal with on your own. But sometimes when we proceed too carefully, that ends up becoming avoidance. So hopefully you can kind of sense in your own body, like when you are making forward progress, but you're going slow and steady so that it's sustainable versus just avoiding it altogether, but calling it, oh, I'm just going slow, but really you're not, you're just avoiding it. So here's a neutral statement. When you are triggered, your nervous system is dysregulated and your triggers matter. Whether you face them or not is entirely up to you. Notice if you feel any resistance or objection or offense or whatever in your body. Literally anything has the potential to be a trigger. This is a joke, but it's actually true, including the all caps on this slide. I don't know how many of you have been in my world on Instagram from the very beginning, but there was a time when for graphic design purposes, I would put all caps on my Instagram slides, or I would make certain words that I wanted to emphasize be all caps. And people lost their shit over it. They're like, "You're yelling at us. I wish you weren't yelling." And I'm like, "Wow, you guys, like, wow, I'm just trying to emphasize a word and you think I'm like yelling at you. And why would I yell at only two words in a sentence and like say the rest of the words normally? Like, who does that?" But people were triggered because I posted slides that had all capital letters. Like, literally, you can go back to some of those times, you'll find those posts and you'll see in the comments where people are losing their shit because they think I'm yelling at them. So that's why that joke is there, because literally anything has the potential to be a trigger. So triggers are both external and internal. Some examples of external triggers are people, places, things, events, facial expressions, styles of communication that remind us of our original trauma, visiting your parents, having an anniversary of a trauma, hearing someone who uses a shaming tone toward you or toward someone else. The way someone looks at you can be triggering. Public speaking can be triggering. Authority figures can be really triggering. I'll tell you, I don't know why for myself. I've always been really curious about this, but I am extremely afraid of like police officers and law enforcement, even though I've never had a bad experience with a cop. And like, I haven't had like a speeding ticket in probably 15 years or something. Like, I haven't had any kind of like bad experience with a cop. I've never been to jail. I've never been searched. I've never been like even close to being arrested. Like, but for some reason, if I pass a state patrol officer on the highway, or like if I pass a cop in the city or something like that, like, I have that like feeling that just like goes through the body that starts at the solar plexus and kind of like explodes outwards. That's kind of prickly, but also really uncomfortable. Does anybody know that feeling that I'm talking about? That like feeling? Like, it happens to me every time I pass a cop, and I have no idea why, but that's like clearly a trigger, but I don't know what the root of the trigger is. David and I were riding our four-wheeler last weekend, and we were on a trail that goes parallel to the highway, and two unmarked trucks pulled up on the side of the road next to us and turned their lights on, and they were like pulling us over on our four-wheeler. And I was like instantly like so anxious, so afraid, like wondering what we had done. It turns out that David just didn't have the lights on the four-wheeler on whenever we were driving, and like apparently you're supposed to drive with your lights on like all the time. But just the way they interrogated us and like how suspicious they seemed, and like, and we weren't doing anything wrong. And like, but you would have thought by the way they were like interrogating us, you would have thought that like David was kidnapping me and we had like a dead baby in the back of the four-wheeler and we were going to sell their organs or something. Like, that's how like extreme these conservation officers were being. So I was for sure triggered, and I was like low-key anxious about it for the rest of the day. And I still have no idea why I have these feelings about law enforcement officers, but I do. So internal triggers, these are things that are happening on the inside, whether it's our body or our mind. So things like physical pain or other sensations can feel really triggering, making a mistake, not being perfect, when you notice things through a negative lens, when you perseverate about what has or could go wrong, when you are catastrophizing or having thoughts of endangerment, or you basically have an off the rails inner critic. Like, the voice in your head is just everything is a problem and it's all inside of you. And maybe you look totally normal on the outside and nobody knows what's going on in the inside, but you know that you're triggered. So if you don't see your specific triggers listed, that's okay, because literally anything can be a trigger. And it's okay if you're triggered by those things. It doesn't mean anything bad or wrong about you. It's just the way that we're wired. It's the way that our bodies are trying to protect us, even from things that logically might not make sense sometimes. So, yes, triggers can feel scary, overwhelming. They can even make us feel like we're dying. It's very, very uncomfortable to get triggered. And also, triggers are pathways to consciousness if we allow them to be. Triggers can be an invitation to deeper self-awareness and healing. They are opportunities to make different choices, conscious choices that support the reality and the outcome we desire. That doesn't mean we get that outcome every single time, but we have a chance to make a choice that supports that outcome. Triggers are an open doorway to freedom if we're willing to walk through it. Imagine how much more free you would feel if something that's a big trigger for you wasn't so much a big trigger anymore, right? Like that would feel really freeing, wouldn't it? Triggers are also invitations to self-responsibility and agency. Triggers prove that we can feel and experience hard, uncomfortable things and still be okay. Everyone in this room has been triggered before, and everyone is here, and you were okay, even if that experience was painful or uncomfortable. Triggers also show us where our boundaries have been crossed or where we might need to set a boundary. So for all of these reasons, I don't think triggers are bad. I think they're necessary and important. And I think that our resistance to them makes sense. But also if we can push past that resistance and actually just like feel whatever it is we want to avoid feeling, then we learn, oh, I can be uncomfortable and that was hard, but I'm actually okay. Complex PTSD triggers, which are also called emotional flashbacks, can present with overt, obvious cues and covert, subtle cues that you might not recognize as a trigger. Sometimes these flashbacks can last a few moments and they pass with very little uneasiness. And sometimes flashbacks can last days, weeks, or months. And remember, complex PTSD triggers are different than post-traumatic stress triggers, because a post-traumatic stress trigger often comes with like a visual mental image of, you know, something like replaying that you experienced. Whereas complex PTSD triggers are more emotional. So you may not get that like visual image of what it is that's so disturbing and scary to you, because, but you just have this like general feeling of unease or this constant anxiety, or you have a conversation with someone and then the people pleaser part of you is like, oh my gosh, what did I say? I must've been so stupid. Like, and you replay everything that you said in that conversation. That's being in an emotional flashback. Anybody do that? Where you like have a conversation with someone and then you leave and then you text them and then they don't text you back right away. And you're like, shit, I must've said something. Shit. I said something I shouldn't have said. And then you replay the whole conversation and you're like, oh, I can't figure out what it was, but it must be something. That's a complex PTSD emotional flashback. It doesn't come with any visual images. It's just this feeling, right? That's so uncomfortable. So I would like to share about a prolonged and repeated emotional flashback that I had to intensely work through for over a year, starting in the fall of 2022. I'm going to stop sharing my screen so that you can just see my face for this part. In September of 2022, my mom was having a major back surgery. And she asked me to come down to Texas where she lives and stay with her and take care of her after her back surgery. And so I was like, yes, of course, I will do that. No problem. And the only time that I had seen my mom before was 2 years earlier in the fall of 2020. So we went 2 full years without seeing each other or being in the same space because of COVID. And so this was my first time to see my mom in 2 years. Well, in the 2 years from 2020 to 2022, guess who had been doing a ton of work on themselves? Like, I had been facing my triggers. I'd been learning to set boundaries. I had been finding my voice. I was like excavating through the shit to find and embody the authenticity that already existed within me, right? So then I get to my mom's and she has the back surgery, and my mom has a history of prescription drug addiction. And so she was going to be on pain medications that she was once addicted to. And so that was a concern for all of us. So my brother and I were like totally in charge of her medication. She never had access to it. We dosed it to her on a schedule that we wrote down and very organized about it. But my mom has not done the level of personal work that I have done on myself. And so she got a different version of me than the one she had experienced 2 years prior, but she was not all that different. So her experience of me was different, but my experience of her was kind of the same. And my mom's patterns are that she can be very, very passive aggressive. She doesn't use her words to directly communicate or ask questions or ask for what she needs or what she wants. She either gets passive aggressive or she shuts down and gives the silent treatment. And this was a super common experience in my childhood. I would say at least 60% of the time, like if I came home from school, what all kids want when they get home from school is for their mom to just like hold her arms out and be like, oh, I'm so happy to see you. How was your day? Tell me everything. What did you do? Who did you play with? Like all of that. What I often got was my mom's back turned to me in the kitchen. I'm a very highly sensitive person, so I can pick up on off energy extremely quickly. And I would come home and she wouldn't turn around to face me. And so then my little spidey senses in my body are like, something's not right here. So my fight flight response would activate. And as most children's fight flight response does, that serves in pursuit of the parent. So the child doesn't want to fight against their parent and they don't want to run away from their parent. Their fight flight response is giving them the energy and mobilization to pursue the parent so that they can reestablish that attachment connection that's so necessary for survival. So the way that I pursued my mom was, what's wrong? Is everything okay? Did I do something wrong? Are you mad at me? What did I do wrong? And often the answer that I would get was this very flat, one word, monotone, no affect, no nothing. Like it was like nothing. So I would be like, what's wrong? Is everything okay? Yep, it's fine. Did I do something wrong? Nope. Without looking at me, without turning towards me, like, and it just made me fucking crazy on the inside of my body, because here is this person who is my trusted caregiver and I'm supposed to be able to trust what she says. And she's telling me everything is fine, but everything in my body is like, everything is not fucking fine. This is not fine. Why won't you look at me? Why won't you have any kind of tone in your voice? Why can't you give me more than a one word answer? So when all of my pursuit didn't work, then guess what I did? That's when I went into people pleasing mode. So then I would start trying to find something to do around the house that might get her to notice me and that might earn her attention back. So I would like clean something, or I would rearrange the decorations on the mantle, or I'd pull a straight A report card out of my bag, or like whatever I could do. Because eventually, if I threw enough spaghetti noodles on the wall, one of them would stick and she would snap out of her state and she would reattach to me. But it was like jumping through hoops, trying to get that to happen. And it was almost seemed like it was different every time. Anyway, now you guys know where all my fucking abandonment shit comes from. Okay. Like that, what I just described is such classic emotional abandonment and neglect. Okay. My mom was not emotionally available for me. She was shut down. She was passive aggressive. She was giving me the silent treatment there. You know, if she had been able to be like, Lindsay, you're home from school. Guess what? I kind of had a bad day. Can I have a few minutes to myself to get myself together? And then I can't wait to talk about how your day at school was. I can't wait for you to help me make dinner. I can't wait to unload your lunchbox together. Like that would have been enough. Like that would have been good enough, you know? Then I wouldn't have thought that I'd done something wrong. I wouldn't have had to earn her attention and affection and an attachment back. I wouldn't have been throwing spaghetti against the wall, trying to figure out what worked. I wouldn't have had all this uncomfortable anxiety in my body. I wouldn't have developed the superpower of hypervigilance that I have today. That's for damn sure. That's where my hypervigilance came from. So anyway, now that you know the history, fast forward to the fall of 2022, when I'm staying at her after she's had surgery and she starts doing some of those same things, very predictable mom stuff. She's being passive aggressive towards me. She's not using her words to communicate what she wants. She's like assuming that I know what she needs when I don't. She's giving me the silent treatment. She's just being very, very difficult. But I was not the same Lindsay. And so for the first time in my life, like my mom told me that I was too sensitive. And instead of listening to her and saying, oh, I'm sorry, I won't be so sensitive, I was like, you don't get to talk to me like that. You don't get to tell me I'm too sensitive. Like, no. And she hated it. And then another time she was like on the couch on her iPad and she was like banging on the screen of her iPad. And I'm in the kitchen washing dishes and I can hear her banging on the screen of her iPad and like, you know, just being passive aggressive. So I like, I'm like, mom, is everything okay? Like, I hear you banging on your iPad and like sighing a lot. Is everything okay? And she's like, I'm fine. And I was like, no, mom, you're not fine. So again, the first time in my life I've ever like called out her behavior. I was like, no, mom, you're not fine. If you were fine, you wouldn't be in there banging on your iPad screen and huffing and puffing and breathing like this. Like, why don't you use your words and tell me what's going on? And she was like, well, Lindsay, I'm just bored. And this was like, I don't know, 10 days after her surgery or something. And I was like, oh my gosh, of course you're bored. Of course you are. Neither one of us was prepared for you to be bored. We thought that you would be like drugged up all the time. We thought you'd be sleeping all the time, that you'd want to spend a bunch of time in bed. You've played games on your phone. You've watched TV. You're bored of all of those things. I was like, it makes total sense that you're bored. What can I do to help you? Can I go get you a coloring book and some colors from the store? Can I download a new game on your phone? I brought this book. Would you like me to read to you? I start like throwing out all of these suggestions. And her response was, it's fine. I'll just do it myself. I lost my shit a little bit. Lost my shit just a little bit. I like called David and was like, book me a plane ticket home right now. I'm done. I'm totally done with her. Anyway, I didn't end up coming home right then. I did end up staying for the full 2 weeks. It was a very uncomfortable experience. Afterwards, I would call or text her like every day. How are you doing? Have you started physical therapy yet? How are you feeling? All of that. One word answers or no response. I could almost hear her tone in the text when I'd be like, how are you feeling today? And she's fine. You know, like that would be what I would get back. And I'm like, oh, I can hear the like flat affect, no emotion, no nothing, right? You're giving me nothing. And so I took that as like, whether she's using her words or not, she doesn't want to talk to me. And that's why she's giving me these answers. These one word answers are not answering me at all. So I backed way off. I quit asking how she's doing. I quit asking how she's feeling. I quit asking about physical therapy. I just quit talking to her. Not to go no contact or cut her out of my life. I didn't say anything like that. I was just like, she clearly needs some space. She's clearly like upset about something. I don't know what that is. I'm going to give her some space. And if she comes and tells me about it, great. She didn't talk to me for 8 months. And then, so the longest silent treatment I've ever gotten, right? So then, during those 8 months, a very interesting series of events unfolded. And it was like, I needed to have that prolonged space from her in order to go deeper than I'd ever been able to go into my abandonment. Because now this was like the ultimate abandonment, right? She's like now not speaking to me for 8 months. And then after 8 months, she only sent me an email and was like, the way you treated me when you were here was absolutely unacceptable. And it, do not respond to this email unless you have something nice to say. Like that was her response. And I like my response back was, well, I can tell that you're really affected by my time there. What if we schedule a phone call so that we can both talk about our experiences in a mutually beneficial way? Are you open to that? And her email response back was, I am. And that was it. So then I was like, okay, once again, the responsibility is on me to now set this up and make this conversation happen. And like, I'm just not doing it. I'm not going to be responsible for her again. If this is what she wants, she can say, yeah, let's have a conversation tomorrow. Or how about this Saturday? Or, you know, whatever. But she didn't. She just gave me this one, like, I am. And that's it. So I didn't say anything. A few more months went by. It was my birthday. She texted me on my birthday. Happy birthday. I love you. I hope you have a fabulous day. It was my 40th birthday. And I texted back. Hi, it's great to hear from you. I'd love to talk to you later today. Are you free? Well, I've got a lot of stuff going on. I'll have to see. My mom is single. She has no friends. My birthday was on a Sunday this year. The only thing my mom does on Sundays is like clean her house. So I never got to talk to her on my birthday. Like, okay. Then her birthday was in July. So I texted her, happy birthday, mom. I love you. She texts back, thank you. We still didn't talk. We still didn't talk. We still didn't talk. Finally, in February of this year, we finally had our first phone conversation. So it's a year and a half of basically no contact with my mom. I am so grateful for that year and a half because I got to go deeper into my abandonment, into my hypervigilance, into my triggers than I'd ever gone before. But this time I had the chance to go into those triggers and explore them curiously in the container of safer relationships. So I wasn't exploring it in my relationship with my mom because she wasn't there. Instead, I was getting triggered in my relationship with David and in my relationship with my best friend and in my relationship with my friend Mark. That's where I was getting triggered. So they got to be the mirror or the thing that poked the trigger. But instead of getting the toxic responses like I would have gotten from my mom, I finally had a space where I could start to name what I was feeling, what I was experiencing, what the voice in my head was telling me, all the catastrophic thoughts, the boom sensation that would go through my body. Like I got to start naming that and exploring it and crying about it and angering about it. I did so much anger work of literally like in my imagination, like seeing my mom with her back turned to me as a child. And I'm like screaming at her, fucking turn around and talk to me. Like I moved so much in that experience. And a lot of Fuel Without Fear comes from that year and a half of working through that massive, massive, massive abandonment trigger. And I can tell you that today I am in a place where it's not that I never get triggered. It's not that I'm never hypervigilant. I am. That does happen sometimes. But I have language to describe my experience and to say what I'm feeling and to ask for what I need. I have awareness that the person now is not actually abandoning me, that I'm just reacting to a present moment resurrection of a past trauma and emotional experience. I can move through the trigger more quickly now with the awareness that I have. The physical sensations that I feel are turned way down from what they used to be. And I don't believe that I could have done it if I had had contact with my mom during that time. It's like I had to get the most toxic person out of my life for a bit to be able to face this thing in the container of safe relationships. So that is a prolonged emotional, I mean, that emotional flashback lasted pretty intensely for probably 8 or 9 months. And then it started to finally go down, but that was a prolonged flashback. So now I will share my screen with you again, and we will continue with our slides. All right. So as I said, the trigger was abandonment, or it was my perception that I was being abandoned. David was not actually abandoning me, but if he was like a little more withdrawn than usual or quieter because he hadn't slept well the night before, or he was, you know, something heavy was on his mind or whatever, in my body, that registered the same way as it registered when my mom's back was turned to me and she was giving me these like one word flat answers. I recently had a very interesting conversation with my best friend. My best friend is very involved in Al-Anon, and she was talking to me about practicing loving detachment. And I was like, I need you to explain this to me. Like, I cannot wrap my head around loving detachment. Like, how can I be detached and still love someone? Because for me, like, I think detachment might feel like dissociation, but when somebody else lovingly detaches from me, it registers in my body as abandonment. Like, I don't know how to work through that. I don't know how to get over that. So there's still little parts of this that I'm still exploring, like the concept of loving detachment that I haven't quite wrapped my head around yet, but I'm so much better than what I was before, much less triggered. So now, or rather my whole life, but now I have language to know that I am really sensitive to nonverbal and verbal communication cues, especially with those who I have intimate relationships with. So this is hypervigilance. It's like I notice tone and inflection and body language and facial expression. And when I'm really, really triggered, I'm even sensitive to like, why did you use the past tense of that verb? Why didn't you use it in the present tense? Like I can be very annoyingly sensitive about it. And I tend to be more hypervigilant around people that I'm in emotionally intimate relationships with. And hypervigilance is an adaptive survival pattern that I developed to protect me from potential abandonment as a child. So I don't have like a series of events in my memory of how I developed hypervigilance, but I know that I developed hypervigilance because if I could somehow read my mom and her emotional state and then predict what she was going to do, then maybe I could avoid the abandonment, if that makes sense. Sometimes I was successful and sometimes I wasn't. But anyway, that is my abandonment story, my abandonment trigger, how I developed hypervigilance, and how I've had to work through it as an adult. So my pattern is that I would be hypervigilant and perceive that I had disappointed someone or that they didn't approve of me based on the verbal and nonverbal communication cues I was perceiving. So their tone, their facial expression, their body language, et cetera. When I was really triggered and not in awareness, I struggled to stay present. And I would either do two things. I would either dissociate and collapse because it was too much for me to handle, and I couldn't speak up for myself because I would lose access to my words. Or the other reaction I would have is that I would be very defensive and sometimes even pick a fight with that person, because at least picking a fight made them engage with me. And that engagement was better than the perceived withdrawal or silent treatment, if that makes sense. So in my life experience with abandonment, which is my core wound, it is my core trauma, I believe that that is the pattern that I am on this planet to heal in myself, is abandonment. There was always one of two possible outcomes. And this goes all the way back to my early, early childhood. The first outcome is they're going to leave me, whether they physically leave me or they emotionally check out or shut down or whatever, they're going to leave me. Meaning their loving, nurturing presence and the safety of the relationship goes away. The silent treatment is how I most often experienced this type of emotional abandonment. The other option, if they didn't leave me, then I leave myself in an attempt to keep them from leaving me. So this is self-abandonment. This is self-abandoning to avoid being abandoned. So when I self-abandoned, I fawned, I people-pleased. As I got older, I wouldn't have boundaries. I would be very reactive. I would try to earn people's love and attention and affection back. But there were only ever two outcomes. If you find yourself in a space of like, well, I can either do this or I can do this, that's called binary thinking. And that is almost always a big fat clue that you are in a trauma response, because you can only see two possible outcomes. I can see so many more outcomes now than either they leave me or I leave myself to avoid being left. There's so many more outcomes available to me now. But when I was in this traumatized, triggered state, I was in binary thinking, and these two options were all that were available to me. Does that make sense? Okay, awesome. So what were the clues that I was in an emotional flashback? So I have a disorganized attachment style, which means I am both anxious and avoidant. So I would try to avoid the other person. I would like dread hanging out with them, or I would make up excuses to avoid hanging out with them. I would second guess myself and I would second guess the relationship. Even like, are we as good of friends as I thought we were? Are we as close as I thought we were? Am I making up stuff about this relationship that isn't true? I would notice everything negative about the relationship. I would dwell on their facial expressions, their body language, their tone, or whatever as proof that I was right, that yes, I am being abandoned. I would also self-abandon by avoiding the topic, not speaking up for myself, not setting boundaries. And I would be hypervigilant when we were together, looking for any sign that they were upset with me, and then trying to be perfect, which is perfectionism is another way that we self-abandon to avoid being abandoned. So remember when I told you I only had those two options, either they leave me or I leave myself to avoid them leaving me. Those were the only options when I wasn't aware of the trigger or my ability to feel without fear and regulate my nervous system. These two options are no longer congruent with who I am today, meaning these two options are now outside of my authenticity. Neither one of these things feels authentic for me anymore. I am a more aware, curious, embodied person than I've ever been. And my perspective is much more open to many more possibilities. Like, it is now possible for me to speak up for myself. It is possible for me to ask for clarification if I misread someone's social cue. I can communicate consciously now. I can say how I'm feeling. I can say how I'm reading and interpreting what the other person is doing. I can share what the voice in my head is saying. I can also set boundaries now. And I used to not be able to set boundaries. So do you see how many more options have opened up outside of the binary? Okay. So, neuroplasticity, we talked a little bit about this in the first workshop, that awareness is a catalyst for neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to rewire itself in response to stress or stimulus. A trigger is definitely a stress and a stimulus, right? So we need neuroplasticity to rewire our brains, to calm down our limbic brain, which is where our survival responses live, and to reprogram our reticular activating system. We also need opportunities to be in emotional flashbacks to practice feeling, meeting ourselves with compassion, setting boundaries, and widening our windows of tolerance to stress and discomfort. So even though they're not fun, triggers are a catalyst for neuroplasticity. We need them to rewire how we automatically respond to things. So whether you are triggered, moderately dysregulated, or mildly dysregulated, the goal is to notice, right? To come into awareness. Hopefully quickly, but it takes practice to come into awareness quickly. Sometimes it takes a while. We repeat the thing over and over and over. And then eventually we're like, oh, I'm doing the thing again. Oh, okay, I'm doing it right now. So all we can do is notice. What does it feel like? We don't have to judge it. We don't have to fix it. We don't have to make it go away. We don't have to pick up our phone and escape from it by scrolling. We can just be present with whatever it is. Even if it's really uncomfortable, even if another person is in the room with us, it's okay when someone else is in the room with you to go, hey, pause. I need to just like be present with what I'm feeling for a moment and like catch up in this conversation. I know that might sound like a very radical, weird thing to say, but it is actually possible. So this means we have to slow down. You're going to find that slowing down is a big theme in Feel Without Fear. Because our fast-paced, rushed, hustling, urgent lifestyles keep us in this kind of low-grade, chronic state of dysregulation anyway. And so maybe you're objecting, like, oh, I don't have time to slow down. What do you mean? I dysregulated all the time. I'm uncomfortable all the time. I would never do anything except be present with dysregulation if I was doing this all the time. Okay. Is anybody having that feeling or that thought? But I'm so dysregulated all the time. I'm so uncomfortable all the time. All I would ever do is just sit and feel and feel and feel and feel. And I don't have time for that. Okay. Katarina's like, yeah, okay. That's great. That's so great that you have the awareness that you have these thoughts. So be curious about it. Isn't it interesting how you're dysregulated so much? Isn't it interesting that you have resistance to slowing down? Who has resistance to slowing down? Just curious. Amazing. I wonder why your nervous system is so dysregulated. I wonder why you have this resistance to slowing down. Is it because you're like overscheduled? Are you working too much? Are your kids in too many extracurricular activities and you're like a taxi driving them around all the time? Do you have a long commute, so you're just in the car a lot? Are you so used to a fast-paced life that slowing down seems boring or empty? Is the way you're living your life stressing out your nervous system? So then, whenever you're triggered, it's like big explosion when it doesn't have to be, but you're just like reacting as if you have a bunch of pressure in a pressure cooker and you temporarily let a little bit of steam off, right? I wonder what shifts you could make in yourself or in your life so that slowing down is a non-negotiable instead of a luxury, or that slowing down is something that you actually enjoy and prioritize instead of something that you do as a last resort because you're burned out and you've realized, oh shit, I have to slow down now. Right? All right. So now let's get really sciencey. We're going to talk about what the nervous system and the brain have to do with our triggers because you are experiencing a biological, physiological process. It's not just energetic and emotional. So we're going to review a little bit of the nervous system. Who all has watched the workshop Nervous System 101 that you got for free when you signed up for this program? Okay, amazing. Several of you have. So, this is going to be some review for you. I review nervous system a lot because by the end of this, I want you to be able to explain polyvagal theory as like an elevator pitch to someone. Like, I want you to be able to see the ladder in your mind's eye and be able to share with a stranger on the street. Like what all the different states are and how they're characterized. Okay, so we're going to review this a lot. So you'll remember from that workshop that your nervous system is the main communication network between your brain and the rest of your organs and systems. It's like the command central of your body. It is an electrical operating system. So, like, all of the nerves going through your body are like wires in a house. And it communicates through sensations, which tell us how we are in relationship to our internal and external environments. The nervous system also coordinates our emotions and how intensely we react to stressors. And there's three branches in the human nervous system: the sympathetic, the parasympathetic, and the social engagement system. When your nervous system is functioning optimally, it is orchestrating everything automatic in your body. The word autonomic comes from the word automatic. So everything that you don't have to think about or make yourself do or remember or take a pill for or whatever else, your nervous system is doing all by itself. Your heartbeat, your breathing, your circulation, your hormone production, your digestion, your temperature, your sleep cycle, your detoxification, your reproductive cycle. Your nervous system is the master commander of all of those things. So then when we have really dysregulated nervous systems that aren't very resilient, what starts going awry in our body? It's like all having to do with the automatic functioning of our bodies, isn't it? So here is a diagram of the human nervous system. We have the parasympathetic over here on the left, and we have the sympathetic nervous system on the right. These are like the yin and the yang of the body. Parasympathetic is the yin, and sympathetic is the yang of the body, and they basically do equal and opposite functions. So the parasympathetic nervous system constricts your pupils, the sympathetic nervous system dilates your pupils. And do you know why, when you're in a sympathetic fight flight state, your pupils dilate? Anybody want to be brave and take a guess why your pupils dilate when you're in a fight flight state? Yeah, Sinead?
Sorry, so you can take in all of the information so you can maybe see everything? No?
Yes,
I'm
yeah.
assuming.
Yep. You need more light and more stuff coming in so that you can make a more instinctive or the ideal instinctive choice to save your life. Right. So you need like everything to be in your vision. Great answer. So your parasympathetic nervous system over here, this is the energy conservation aspect of your body. Your parasympathetic nervous system is the brakes of your body. You may have heard it called rest and digest or feed and breathe. Those are like really popular ways of describing the parasympathetic nervous system. Although, whenever people describe it that way, they make it sound like you're always supposed to be in a parasympathetic state because it's the most ideal to be in rest and digest and feed and breathe all the time. But rest and digest and feed and breathe is actually your social engagement system, which is a sub branch of your parasympathetic nervous system. But when you don't have that social engagement system activated and you just have the parasympathetic nervous system, that's your dorsal vagal collapse or shutdown, which is why it's the brakes of the body. And which is why, even though it's usually labeled good, it's not always good. Because if any of you have been in a prolonged collapsed state, then you have been in a prolonged dorsal vagal shutdown, which you know is not a super fun state to be in and not ideal and doesn't feel like rest and digest and feed and breathe, does it? Feels very different to that. When the parasympathetic is too aroused, meaning the brake is like fully pressed, then the situation or the threat is too much or out of control. And this is when we shut down or freeze. Mammals, reptiles, birds, and fish have the ability to freeze in the face of overwhelming danger. And this snake is obviously a reptile. And reptiles don't have a social engagement system. So they only have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. So in this snake, it's not dead. It's actually playing dead. It's in a freeze state because many predators are not interested in something if it's already dead. Scavengers are interested in things that are already dead, not predators. So if you can play dead when you're being chased by a lion, then the lion is more likely to lose interest in you because the lion isn't a scavenger, it's a predator. And then freeze also occurs on a spectrum. If you have not seen it yet, you have access to my workshop that's called Thawing the Freeze Response, which is a deep, deep dive into the freeze state in the nervous system. And you will learn in that workshop that it is on a spectrum. So it's anything from like the inability to use words or like boredom or apathy, all the way down to like shutdown, depression, hopelessness, and shame. Now we'll talk about the sympathetic. So this is the yang of the body. This side of our nervous system is responsible for energy expenditure. This is our fight flight state. It is often labeled bad, that it's bad to be in a fight flight state. But this is the gas of your body. So it's not bad because you need the gas. Just like your car needs gas and your car needs a brake, you also need the gas and the brake in your body. So it's not bad to be in a sympathetic state. What they don't clarify when people say it's bad to be in a sympathetic state is when you're in a sympathetic nervous system state as an inappropriate or disproportionate response to the threat that is present. That's a lot of the context that people often leave out. So here is our polyvagal ladder. The states that are in black are primary nervous system states. And what this means is that there's only one set of neural pathways active in your brain and body when these states are engaged. So these states are your social engagement system, your sympathetic fight flight response, and your dorsal vagal shutdown. We also have secondary nervous system states, which are in blue. And secondary nervous system states are when two primary nervous system states combine. So you have two sets of neural pathways active at the same time. So when you have your sympathetic fight flight response, the gas coupled with the brakes of your parasympathetic dorsal vagal response, the combined state is freeze. So that's the gas and the brakes are being pressed in your body at the same time. In my opinion, it's the most difficult state to be in. It's also the most difficult state to work with as a practitioner. When you have the safety of your social engagement system combined with the mobilization of your sympathetic nervous system, that is what creates the state of play, workflow, and creativity. So if you think about when children are playing, they're laughing, they're running around, they're having tons of fun. So they're clearly safe, but they also have a lot of movement, right? Because they're running, they're using a bunch of energy. So that's the state of play. And then when you combine the safety of your social engagement system with the brake of your dorsal vagal system, that forms the state of stillness. So again, this is why it's not bad to have your brake on, because you need that brake to access the state of stillness. Deb Dana, who's a famous polyvagal teacher, says polyvagal theory helps us understand that behaviors are manifestations of our internal nervous systems taking actions in the service of survival. People develop habits based in early adaptive survival responses, and these habits naturally continue into adulthood. When we can recognize how these responses once served a person by helping them tolerate seemingly unbearable circumstances, we are able to cultivate a sense of appreciation for how an individual has survived, adapted, and learned through the difficult experiences and predicaments of their life. This leaves us with the option of a recovery paradigm that creates meaning out of the varied experiences within an individual's mind-body-spirit continuum, rather than putting emphasis on a need to overcome the so-called mental illness. This quote right here is why I believe mental illness isn't real. It's just adaptive responses that our nervous systems developed to keep us alive, and they make total sense in the context of those environments and experiences. And when we can cultivate appreciation for those adaptive responses and validate how much they make sense, then you see there's nothing wrong with your mind. You don't have a mental illness. You have a collection of adaptive behaviors that you learned in order to survive. And those things can be unlearned. Also in the body keeps the score, when the autonomic nervous system is balanced, flexible, and resilient, we have a reasonable degree of control over our response to minor frustrations and disappointments, enabling us to calmly assess what's going on. Effective arousal modulation gives us control over our impulses and emotions. As long as we manage to stay calm, we can choose how we want to respond. Individuals with poorly modulated nervous systems are easily thrown off balance, both mentally and physically. Lack of resilience and flexibility in the nervous system not only has negative effects on thinking and feeling, but also on how the body responds to stress. When you are in a less resilient, less flexible nervous system state, even tiny minor stressors that really aren't that big of a deal will feel extremely overwhelming in your body. So the goal is not to be at the top in the social engagement system all the time. That is unrealistic. It's impossible. That's not even ideal. It's not the goal. The goal is to have a nervous system that can flexibly move up and down the ladder in and out of those states and respond appropriately to threats. So every move up and down that ladder is our nervous system's effort to keep us safe and alive. The more primitive immobilization response is only activated when our more evolved social engagement or sympathetic functions fail. So our fight flight response is always, always, always our body's first line of defense. Your first line of defense is never to freeze or shut down. That is more of when your sympathetic fight flight has failed, the only place you have to go for survival is down into collapse. Okay. So if you are someone who, for example, when you experience anger, and you judge your anger, or you think you aren't supposed to be angry, or you think it's inappropriate to be angry, then you will repress or suppress your anger. Therefore, the anger energy doesn't have anywhere to go to get you to safety. So if you can't use your anger to get to safety and you repress or suppress it instead, then your nervous system can't go up. It can only go down into collapse or shutdown. Does anyone ever experience that where you don't let yourself get angry and then you find yourself being collapsed? Yeah, Danielle. Okay. Amazing. Now you know why. Take another drink here. So literally anything has the potential to be stored as trauma in the body, depending on how your individual nervous system responds. This also means literally anything has the potential to be a trigger because it's all based in your own subjective nervous system experience. Every nervous system on this planet functions exactly the same way, but some nervous systems are more resilient and flexible than others. Your nervous system may be intolerant of things and people that other nervous systems can tolerate, and vice versa. And it doesn't have to mean anything about you. So now let's talk about the brain and what happens in our brains when we are triggered. It is the same thing that happens when a real threat is present. Your brain doesn't know the difference between a perceived threat and a real threat. So we'll start with our amygdala, which is this little almond-shaped thing in the middle of our brain. This is our fear center. This is also where we experience pleasure-based emotional learning and fearful emotional learning. Our amygdala stores memories of stimuli that are related to fear. And this is where expressions of fear and aggression come from. The amygdala is only concerned with survival. It does not care about the quality of our life. Its only job is to keep us alive by keeping us safe. We know from brain scans and research that trauma can enlarge the amygdala in the brain. So the amygdala will actually grow bigger with trauma, which means that a larger amygdala is more likely to perceive non-threatening things as threatening. Our amygdala also stores instinctive memories for survival. So if we were walking through the woods and we heard a stick crack in the distance and we looked off and we saw a bear and we immediately turned around and ran away, the amygdala is going to store that information because we survived. And then the next time we come across something scary in the woods, whether it's a bear or a moose or something else, then we're going to do exactly the same thing again subconsciously because the amygdala is like, oh, that worked the first time for survival. Let's do it again. Your amygdala also works in conjunction with your hippocampus, which is this part of the brain here. So the hippocampus creates memory of environment, space, events, and facts. It's also where your behaviors linked to emotional responses are. And it receives input from both the amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain, and the prefrontal cortex or cerebral cortex, which is where the thinking, logical, analytical, reasoning part of our brain is. When we practice awareness, we are using our prefrontal cortex. When we are reacting instead of responding, our amygdala is in charge. Okay. The amygdala, the hippocampus work together. They declare threat. Then the hypothalamus sends a message down the brainstem to activate the nervous system to fight, flee, or immobilize. And all of this happens in milliseconds, like faster than you can even blink. The hypothalamus then releases corticotropic releasing hormones that signal to your pituitary gland to secrete adrenocorticotropic hormone into your bloodstream because you need that adrenaline in order to like move your muscles and fight or run away. Your hypothalamus also turns your emotions into physical responses. So for example, when you feel fear and you notice your heart rate increases, your hypothalamus is who's controlling that. So this series of events, amygdala senses a threat, sends a message to the hippocampus, tells the hypothalamus to produce all of these stress hormones like cortisol and, the hypothalamus tells the pituitary gland to produce stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. That message then goes down the autonomic nervous system. And this is the stress response. It doesn't matter if it's real or perceived. This exact same series of events happens regardless. Our limbic systems, which is what I just showed you, do not know the difference between a real-time trauma and a trigger. The limbic system does not store linear time, okay? So it's not thinking, this didn't actually happen. Like, this thing is not actually in danger right now. I'm just having an emotional flashback experience of something that happened in December of 1992. Like, your fear brain is not thinking that way. It doesn't keep linear time. But the prefrontal cortex does know the difference. This is where we keep linear time. Do you see how we're using two different brains? Basically, we basically have two brains. We have a limbic brain, which is our survival brain. And then we have our like thinking, analytical, aware brain. This is why triggers can be so confusing, because part of you feels like the threat is happening right now, while the rational, logical part of your brain knows that it's not happening right now. And believe it or not, when it comes to thinking, reason, and logic or survival, guess what wins every single time? Survival, every single time. So now we're going to talk about another part of your brain that's called your reticular activating system. So this part of your brain is receiving and filtering input from all of your senses. It connects with your brainstem and spinal cord, cerebrum and cerebellum. It reinforces your deepest subconscious beliefs. So your reticular activating system is where the confirmation bias of your brain and body is. This is also the echo chamber of your mind and your beliefs. So it's always scanning your environment, looking for proof that what you believe is true, even if what you believe isn't factually true. The RAS is a sophisticated filter system that allows certain information to your brain and filters out other information. Guess who programmed that filter? You did. And so did the people from your past. The reticular activating system seeks data that validates your beliefs. It screens the world through the parameters that you give it, and your beliefs form those parameters. Everything in your life is a reflection of your inner state. If you constantly feel unlovable or you think people don't like you at work, your reticular activating system is going to point out every single piece of evidence that confirms that negative belief all day long. Is anyone aware of when their reticular activating system is finding everything in the environment that proves what you believe to be true, but conveniently leaving out everything that would prove that what you believe isn't true? It's happening in your brain. So how do we calm down the amygdala when it's hijacked during a trigger? There is a technique called havening, and I will talk more about this later. And how do we reprogram a reticular activating system that is hell-bent on confirming our subconscious beliefs over and over and over? For that, we use visualization. Your subconscious mind responds powerfully to visualization. I say this with my clients all the time. Your imagination is the most underrated and overlooked portal to your healing that I can think of, is literally your imagination. Because if you can visualize something, especially if you can visualize yourself doing something that the subconscious believes you can't do, you're reprogramming your brain. So remember, your limbic brain, your nervous system, and your reticular activating system are not keeping linear time. This is why you can have a physical reaction or sensation to simply imagining something happening. Okay, so I want you to just imagine right now that something bad happens to your significant other or your child or your pet. Did anyone get a sensation as soon as they had that, like, oh, what if this thing happens? Okay, that's because even though it's not happening, your limbic brain, your nervous system, and your reticular activating system don't give a shit if it's happening in real time or not. The fact that you imagined it is enough. So to your brain and your nervous system, that thing is actually happening in real time, even if you're just imagining it. So when you visualize yourself setting a boundary or feeling your feelings or shifting a pattern, that is happening right now as you visualize it. Just as if you visualize your dog getting hit by a car, even though that's not what is actually happening right now, to the survival part of your brain, it is what's happening right now. Does that make sense? This is like very like meta quantum stuff, isn't it? So with consistency and repetition, you can train your reticular activating system to filter differently, less based on past trauma and more based in the present moment. So hopefully if you feel any shame or anger toward yourself due to your triggers or how you've reacted or maybe hurt others when you were triggered, you can be more compassionate with yourself. Your body and your brain were simply trying to protect you in the most primitive way possible and protecting you in a way that unless you have awareness of it, you don't have any control over. And yeah, there might still be consequences to your actions, right? Relationships to repair, accountability to take, et cetera. But it's always the most compassionate thing to just name that even if I acted out of integrity, even if I hurt this person, even if I need to take accountability, the reaction that I had makes sense in the context of my life experiences. And there's no reason to feel shame or anger about that unless the shame is calling you back into integrity, of course. Because we don't have control over the limbic brain. We don't have control over, the survival response and the fact that our bodies don't keep linear time and all of that. But with awareness, we can gain more control over those things. So back to our ladder, I want to focus on from here down. So this fight, flight, freeze, and shut down is where we're going to talk for a second. So now that you know how your brain and your nervous system are working together to protect you from threats, whether they're real or perceived, you need to know how to recognize the physiological and emotional signs that you're getting triggered and the trauma responses associated with your reactions. Our friend Pete Walker says, recognizing the moment of triggering is even more important than recognizing the trigger itself. So like I was telling you guys earlier, I have this like fear of law enforcement and I don't know what the trigger for that is because I've never had a bad experience with law enforcement, but it doesn't matter if I know why I have the trigger. What matters is that I can recognize the moment when I feel triggered. So we're going to discuss the trauma responses in detail, including how we can meet each response with awareness instead of enacting unconscious reactions on ourselves and others. So our fight response, this is an activation of the sympathetic branch of the nervous system. Fight and flight is always your body's first line of defense. In the fight response, the body is preparing to defend itself against danger using physical force if necessary. So the emotions associated with the fight response, every response in the nervous system and every emotion is on a spectrum. So the primary emotion of the fight response is anger. But anger occurs on a spectrum. It can be anything from irritability and frustration to rage, aggression, and being out of control. Okay. Physiologically, when your sympathetic fight response is activated, your heart rate increases, your breathing becomes quick and shallow, your mouth may dry out, your muscles often tense up, and your face or your skin will flush red. And this is because your body is putting out extra blood flow. Because if you're going to fight or run away, you need extra blood in your body and you need extra oxygen in your lungs in order to make that happen. When we are not conscious of what it feels like to be in a fight response, we will have unconscious reactions. So those can be things like slamming doors, pounding our fists, yelling, needing to be right, trying to control things, mocking, taunting, shaming other people, making sound effects, or even resorting to actual violence. But when integrated, meaning we can feel that anger energy coming through our bodies and we use it, we channel it in a productive way, then we have access to assertiveness. We can set boundaries. We can protect ourselves and others. We have courage, leadership, motivation, and drive. So the same energy that it takes to be explosive, controlling, and demanding is the same energy you need to assert yourself and set a boundary. It's just all about how are you channeling that energy. The same energy that it takes to be intimidating and bullying and demanding is the same energy that it takes to have courage, leadership, motivation, and drive. The question is just, how are you channeling that energy when it comes through your body? What is your level of awareness? All right. So that was your fight response. Now we're going to go to our flight response. Also sympathetic activation. This is when the body prepares to defend itself by running away from danger. So the emotions of the flight response are things like panic, anxiety, concern, feeling agitated, feeling dread. Sensations, same as your fight response, because this is the same neural pathways being activated. So increased heart rate, quick, shallow breathing, muscle tension, face and skin flush. When you're not in awareness and you're reacting unconsciously and you're in a flight response, this is when you're obsessive thinking, you're like hyperactive, you're in perfectionism, you might be in avoidance or like, oh, let's just move on. Let's not talk about it. Constantly busy, worrying a lot. It's like the brain is running, but the body's not moving. It's a lot of times what it is. When we can integrate that flight response and we can catch that energy as it's coming through and realize, oh, I don't actually need to run away from this thing, then we can channel that into perseverance. Perseverance is the primary emotion of the flight response. Perseverance is integrated anxiety. It gives you the energy that you need to see a situation through to the end, which when you're anxious is absolutely unbearable because you want it to be over right fucking now. When our flight response is integrated, we know when we need to disengage in a healthy way. There is an energy of industriousness and resourcefulness, and you know when to retreat, when conflict would put you in danger or when conflict is a waste of energy. But when we are in an unintegrated flight response, that's when we see patterns like workaholism, micromanaging, being constantly busy, being obsessive compulsive, overthinking, being an adrenaline junkie, stuck in the on position, and flitting from one thing to the next, but really not like finishing anything. You're just kind of, I mean, this may sound a lot like ADD or ADHD to you, which can be an unintegrated flight response. So here's where that is on our polyvagal ladder. And next we're in our freeze or immobilization response. So it's commonly but inaccurately called freeze, but it's actually immobilization because freeze, if you'll remember, is the gas and the brakes at the same time. Immobilization is just brakes. So it's an activation of the dorsal vagal branch of the nervous system. And our immobilization response only activates when the nervous system determines that fight and flight have not worked to achieve safety. So then it goes into protecting us through immobilization or energy conservation. And this occurs on a spectrum. So most people are not totally immobilized, which is like all the way down here and unable to move. But if we were to turn this side or vertically, then our fight flight response would be up more towards the top of the, or the middle of the ladder. And now here we're going into more of the bottom of the ladder. So this is kind of the spectrum from like, you know, here's like a little bit of freeze. And then here's like all the way down into like dorsal vagal shutdown. Our emotions of our immobilization response are also on a spectrum. So when it's like mild, it can be something like boredom. When it's really, really bad, it can be all the way down to like depression, being blank and feeling hopeless. A lot of the times when we're in an immobilization response, we just feel stuck and we kind of have this, I just can't, I don't have any energy. I can't move. I can't think, I can't do anything. That's kind of really indicative of a dorsal vagal collapse. Sensations are opposite to what the fight flight response is, because you'll remember these are the yin and the yang of the body. So they do equal but opposite functions. So your heart rate will slow. You may feel like you can't speak or think. You may feel depressed, weak or heavy in your body. You may feel detached or dissociated from your body. And when not in awareness, our unconscious reactions when we're immobilized are things like not being able to make a decision, scrolling, zoning out, not being able to get out of bed, isolating ourselves, shaming ourselves, or even just giving up. When we can integrate immobilization, as you'll see, this is where we can do things like mindfulness and experience peace and calm and presence, stillness, right? It's that combination of safety and immobilization, judiciousness, discernment. Okay. Discernment is such a big one. We're going to talk a lot about discernment in another workshop. Because there's so much judgment about the freeze state, gas in the brakes, because it is such a difficult state to be in. And it's a difficult state to work with because people in the freeze state tend to have very small windows of tolerance. And you have to be really careful not to blow them out of their window of tolerance, because then the contraction is that much worse. But the beautiful thing about the state of freeze is that it puts you in the prime state in your body to be able to have discernment, because it slows you down just enough to be able to like pause and consider all of your options and be judicious. But then there's still a little bit of that gas to be able to make a decision. And so many people are so afraid of the freeze state that they don't honor it for the opportunity for discernment that it gives us, that really we don't have that in any other state in our nervous systems. And discernment is part of intuition. So you actually need access to your brakes and your gas to be in that state. When our immobilization is unintegrated and we're in that freeze state, that's when we see like extreme anxiety, isolation, being withdrawn, being a couch potato, you're unmotivated, but you feel guilty or shame about it. You believe you're a failure. You're afraid of achievement. You're zoning out, you're scrolling, you're procrastinating. So these are, it's all the way down here. You see how far this is from safety? It's like a really long way. you have to mobilize your nervous system up through fight and flight to get to safety. You don't get to bypass and go all the way around it like this. You actually have to mobilize up through. That's in the Thawing the Freeze Response workshop, by the way. All right, now we'll talk about the fawn response, which is not actually a nervous system state. It's not on the polyvagal ladder. However, there is a high level of nervous system activation when someone fawns, because something about your survival feels threatened or you wouldn't fawn. Fawning is a behavioral modification as a reaction to a nervous system state. So you're basically willing to do or say or become whatever is necessary to stop these unbearable feelings of discomfort. You will please anyone. You will serve anyone. You will do whatever it takes to be good and to be worthy and all of this so that you don't have to feel the discomfort. So our emotions of a fawn response is when we're feeling unworthy, unloved. There's a whole lot of resentment with the fawn response. We feel depleted in our energy. We can feel anxious, like we want to be camouflaged, or we don't know what we feel because we're always focused on what everybody else is feeling. Sensations we have in our body are things like anxiety, feeling physically or emotionally drained. A knot in the throat is almost always indicative of something that you need to say, but you're not letting out, which we often keep ourselves quiet to be pleasing to other people. We can get sick to our stomachs, or we might be disconnected or distracted from our bodily sensation, again, because we're focused on everybody else. When we're fawning, we are people-pleasing. We're codependent. We ignore our own needs. We don't have boundaries. We care too much. We give too much. We don't say no. We flatter other people. We deny or avoid conflict. But guess what? You can also have an integrated fawn response. There are some times when fawning is actually necessary and the right thing to do. And that's when you're serving in some way, when you're trying to compromise, when you're peacemaking, when you're caretaking someone. Like if you're caring for an older parent or an older relative, that requires a lot of fawning, because you are actually needing to put that person's needs ahead of your own in order to take care of them the way they need to be taken care of. If that becomes too much for you, and it's outside of your authenticity, that's when you have to learn how to pull back. But if you're consenting to it, I mean, parenting is this way. Like if you're a parent, you know, it's absolutely necessary to put your child's needs above your own needs for a lot of their childhood until they're older and can take care of themselves, right? That requires a healthy ability to fawn. Listening to other people. Like if you are actively listening, I do this with my clients all the time. I am putting my own needs aside to listen to someone else. That requires being able to fawn, but it's not in a bad way. It's not in a way that doesn't serve me. And meeting the attachment needs of children obviously requires a lot of that. But when not integrated, this is when we see our unhealthy fawn response. This is over-serving, over-giving, people-pleasing. You're a doormat, you grovel, you expect yourself to be perfect socially. You say yes, but you really mean no. You lose yourself. You're resentful, but you don't have boundaries, and you self-abandon. If your nervous system goes into fight, flight, mobilization, when you're triggered, you will experience the same increased heart rate, quick, shallow breathing, muscle tension, dry mouth, sweating, and flushing as you would experience if you came face-to-face with a bear in the woods. Physiologically, your body and your nervous system don't know the difference. So if you don't meet that fight response with awareness, You will unconsciously react by yelling at people, getting defensive, hurting someone out of anger. My favorite, arguing with strangers on the internet. There's a lot of people with unintegrated fire responses in my comments, if any of you have ever taken the time to read them. And blaming and shaming others, also lots in my comment section. If you don't meet your flight response with awareness, you can unconsciously react by panicking, avoiding people, places, and other triggers, overthinking, fawning, quitting, trying to be more perfect. If your nervous system goes into parasympathetic immobilization when you're triggered, you will experience the same loss of words, dissociation, stuckness, and shame as when you are overwhelmed with any experience in real time. Physiologically, once again, the body and the nervous system don't know the difference. And if you can't meet that immobilization with awareness, you can unconsciously react by shaming yourself, fawning, zoning out, dissociating, giving up. I don't think the hiding is supposed to have an S. I don't know why there's an S there, but just hiding, not hidings. So more common trigger feelings, right? Because these are emotional flashbacks if we have complex PTSD. So here is a little bit more of that subtle emotional flashback. You feel small, helpless, or hopeless. You have intense shame. You want to run and never be seen again. You feel fragile, on edge, or delicate. There's a major drop in your self-confidence and self-esteem. You're in all or nothing binary thinking. Your inner critic is getting louder and louder and louder. You're increasing in your drasticizing or catastrophizing. And you know that your emotional reaction is out of proportion to the trigger itself. You might also feel especially judgmental of others. That can also be an emotional flashback. You might, like a minor upset could feel like it's an emergency. You are angering at or shaming yourself for hours or days. You feel disgusted with yourself or you hate yourself. You unfairly explode on someone who is innocent. There's intensified self-criticism and self-shaming. And you only find fault with yourself, or you only find fault with others. All right, let's take a quick break. Let's do 4 minutes. So come back at 40 after the hour, and we will continue with the second half of our workshop.